From San Francisco, it's the Peter B. Collins Show. I'm your humble host, Peter B. Glad you're listening. Our program is supported by listeners, and I'm grateful for your help in launching our new podcast series. I want to thank Paul Elsesser of Durham, California, and James Bonaventure of Baldwin, Missouri. Two regular subscribers to the program. The subscription's voluntary, starts as low as $5 a month. Details at peterbcollins.com. You're about to hear the 10th installment in the Boiling Frogs interview series, co-hosted by Sabelle Edmonds. And our guest today is Stephen Cohn. He is the whistleblower's attorney and executive director of the National Whistleblower Center in Washington. And if you are a federal employee and you have sensitive information you've thought about going public with, listen carefully. You'll find out what happens to whistleblowers, and it's not a pretty picture. I'd like to hear your comments. I always appreciate your emails. Just send them to Peter at peterbcollins.com. Welcome to Boiling Frogs.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes.
Everybody knows, but do they? NSA's illegal domestic wiretapping, FBI's national security letters, state secrets privilege, TSA's 1 million-plus no-fly list, persecution of government whistleblowers, perpetual wars, rendition and torture. Can you feel the water boiling? Welcome to the Boiling Frog.
With Sabelle Edmonds, I'm Peter B. Collins. Welcome to this edition of The Boiling Frogs. Our guest today is attorney Stephen M. Cohn of Washington, D.C., co-founder with his brother Michael of the National Whistleblowers Center. And just to keep it clear, this is not the Cohen brothers who make films. These are the Cohn brothers, K-O-H-N, who have defended a whole string of whistleblowers over the years. Stephen, welcome to our program today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
It's nice to talk with you, and just a little history on your organization. You have worked with a number of whistleblowers going back many years, including Linda Tripp, and into the more recent past, you have been working with a number of national security whistleblowers. Now, from what I've been able to glean, your background is in employment law. What got you and your brother interested in the whistleblower aspect of wrongful terminations?
Well, whistleblowing is really a core civil liberties issue of freedom of speech. It's about the public's right to know. It's about the ability to expose fraud, misconduct, and violations of the law. And I became motivated on this issue really as a strong First Amendment background, both through college and graduate school and law school. And I was lucky enough back in 1984, my first job out of law school was to work on behalf of whistleblowers. And to be honest, I didn't even know what the word meant when I was hired. Like, are you going to work for whistleblowers? I said, yeah, what does that mean? And I quickly found out. And it really goes back to very, very significant First Amendment freedoms of this country and really the essence of democracy. It comes to the bottom line. If you don't know, how can you make a meaningful choice in voting? If an electorate is denied information about what its government and politicians are actually doing, how can you have a democracy? And that's really been the struggle and the conflict since the founding of the republic.
And Steve, you started off working with whistleblowers in the nuclear industry and, as I mentioned, a whole range of other cases. But one thread that seems to be common among them all is that none of these individuals are comfortable calling themselves whistleblowers. Explain that that anomaly or contradiction.
The word, really, if you are at work and you witness wrongdoing and you're an honest, sincere employee and you just want to fix it, I mean, you don't see yourself as a whistleblower. You see yourself as a loyal employee doing your job. And if you see misconduct, say like Sybil Edmonds saw, where there was violations of rules and violations of security procedures that would clearly threaten the United States and national security, I mean, you want to protect your country. So you don't see yourself as some type of oddball. You actually see yourself as a dedicated, loyal, mainstream employee. So your first reaction, this is typical, is I'm not a whistleblower. I'm doing my job. I mean, why do I have to have this title? Interesting, at the end of the day, after a couple of years of legal battles or swatting it out with one's employer, most whistleblowers are comfortable with this title and take pride in it, although some people I've worked with will deny they're a whistleblower all the way through till the end of their case.
Sybil?
You and I spoke during this American Library Association's event, and during your speech, you talked about the mother of all whistleblower protection laws that was passed more than 200 years ago, that you said many people are not even aware of it, that this is the mother of all whistleblower protection laws. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes. The mother of all, I mean, the foundation of all whistleblower protection laws is the First Amendment of the United States Constitution. Period. That's it. I mean, read what it says. It first says that Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of speech or the press. Whistleblowing is freedom of speech. And if you study the origin of the freedom of speech, it's what it's all about. The most fundamental freedom was the right to expose government misconduct. That's what the core value of the First Amendment. The First Amendment also protects your right to petition Congress. In other words, to go to Congress and complain. Today we are fighting for the right of federal employees to be able to go to Congress and provide information about official misconduct. It's the position of the Whistleblower Center and my own personal position that that right is absolutely guaranteed in the Constitution, and that any law, rule, or regulation which prevents an employee from going to Congress is unconstitutional. In fact, how can Congress do its job if they can't get information from the employees who know how the taxpayer money is being spent? I mean, this is fundamental to democracy. It's not just the voters, it's also the elected representatives. And what I find dumbfounding is that this is even debated, and that the voters would tolerate such a debate. How can it be debated whether people can go and tell their own elected representative about violations of law that they have personally witnessed, or stealing of government money, or things like torture, or false intelligence information?
Oh, but Steve, you know, we're trying to look forward, not backward.
Look forward. The problem is that the culture in the bureaucracy is so strong that looking forward is a quagmire. I mean, we have to literally battle it out. And I know you're talking now, we have a new administration. But in point of fact, restrictions on federal employee rights and the right to blow the whistle, you know, go back many years, and every president has found the suppression of whistleblowers to be convenient. Because once you're in office, do you want the scandals which may embarrass you out in the front page of the newspaper? That's why we have a constitutional amendment guaranteeing these rights. Because our founding fathers knew way back when that politicians are going to act in their own self-interest, and that's never in the interest of the whistleblower.
Steve, how did we end up with this struggle? Because on one hand, we have this mother of all protections, which is the First Amendment. Then we have things like, okay, a lot of these national security whistleblowers, they had their employment with the with their top secret clearance. And they feel like, and in fact, they have been threatened with the fact that they are obligated to comply with these classifications and gag orders despite this First Amendment right, or else. You know, for example, one thing that happened with Bunny Greenhouse was before she appeared before the Congress to testify, she received this email, her employer, the Army, saying, you can't because you have to clear and get permission from us. And the same thing happened with me. If you remember, before I appeared for a CBS 60 Minutes program, we received this fax from the FBI and the Justice Department threatening us and saying, you know, she had clearance and these things are, we consider, classified, you know, arbitrarily, and therefore you can't. You cannot talk to Congress. You can't talk to the media. And so we have ended up with this struggle. And a lot of people who really want to come forward and disclose information, not classified information, they feel like they are trapped in this trap that is set via having the clearance, via signing these employment forms with these agencies, especially the intelligence agencies. So when you throw these elements in there, what wins? You know, you have on one hand your First Amendment, your duty as a citizen, and your constitutional rights, and your actually duty, obligation. And on the other hand, you have these executively placed classification, again, very arbitrarily, and the clearance rules, and et cetera.
Well, I think the most important place to start in this analysis is with Frederick Douglass's famous quote about progress yielding nothing without a demand. You may know that. And that you find the level of tyrants is established by what those who are under their control are willing to put up with. And Douglass was a runaway slave, and he didn't put up with much. He ran away and then fought slavery. But in the federal sector, I'm going to tell you a story about these non-disclosure agreements and the way they try to coerce and pressure employees to hide the truth. And it's terrible. And Sibel, you lived it. And they will threaten, they will push, and they will use their power to intimidate. But I got to tell you one story. So I'm representing an employee with a top secret clearance. Now, I have no clearance, and I will not submit for a clearance, because I believe if I did, I would be compromised.
Correct.
I only owe a duty of allegiance to my client, period, an undivided duty. So if I had a clearance and I had to be afraid of what the government may do to me if I somehow violated this clearance, I don't think I could represent my client. If I'm in a legal battle on behalf of an employee, I only worry about that employee. I can't worry about whether they're going to nail me for some violation. So it begins with, I think, the lawyers have to say, and many, many lawyers sign these non-disclosure agreements or sign security clearances for the so-called right to represent a national security whistleblower. Now, we don't do that and never will. Okay, so I'll tell you a story. So we're hauled into an investigation in front of the Inspector General on behalf of an employee who was blowing the whistle on the NSA, National Security Agency's, well, he had authority for the NSA's domestic surveillance program, and also for the FBI's National Security Letter Program, and especially the National Security Letter Program was being highly abused. So they call him in for an interview, and they say, Mr. Cohn, if you want to represent this employee, you have to sign this non-disclosure agreement.
Oh, my God.
And I say, well, I looked at it, and if I signed it, I would actually be opening myself up to an obstruction of justice charge if I told anyone what happened in the interview. The non-disclosure said that I'm admitting this is national security sensitive, and that if I were to disclose information, I could be interfering with a national security investigation. So I say, I refuse to sign this. They say, Mr. Cohn, your client, you know, who works for the FBI, says, you know, you have to give the interview without your lawyer because you're our employee and we're demanding that you do it or you're fired. So my poor client looks at me and says, what should I do? And I turned to him. I said, get up and get out of this room. And he's like, what? I grab him literally by the arm and I push him out the door, pretty much, because he was scared. And the inspector general investigators, you know, looks at me and says, you can't control this interrogation. You know, where he has to give the information. You can't do this. And I looked at her straight up and I said, I know I can't, but the U.S. Constitution can. We got up and we walked out. So he's threatened with being fired that same very day. However, after we start our arm wrestle, we checkmate him with two moves. First, their non-disclosure agreement was unconstitutional on its face, and we asserted those rights. We claimed it was an illegal gag order. And second, and here's the funny part, the Attorney General of the United States is an attorney. This was being done under the authority of the Attorney General. Well, guess what? Under the bar rules, an attorney cannot interview a non-attorney without the consent of his attorney. So had the Attorney General pursued this request for information, we could have filed a bar charge and sought his debarment and everyone else, which we threatened. So we had a big fight, and we won that fight. They had to completely modify this so-called non-disclosure agreement to permit me to have all my rights under the U.S. Constitution and the explicit right to go to Congress and expose any wrongdoing that we see as a result of the interview. So in other words, we had to fight like a dog just to get the right to have a non-censored interview. But most lawyers won't do this. Most lawyers will back down. Most employees will back down. And I think that the way this whole situation begins to change is when people assert their rights. And yes, and Sibel knows, unfortunately, that sometimes you can assert those rights, and then the government does something like the state secrets privilege and knocks you out. But I want to tell you something, Sibel, and what's so important here. When you forced them to invoke the state secrets privilege, you actually exposed how weak they were and how vindictive and vicious they were. In other words, you moved the cause of whistleblowing forward by forcing the government to invoke a privilege in a way they never should have, because you had them dead to rights, and they knew you would win if they did not invoke that privilege. They knew that the Inspector General was coming on your side, and they knew that you would win. So they had to pull that trump card. That was damaging to you, and it was very bad. But if you look at the cause of whistleblowing in general, I think, you know, you really moved it forward. In this particular case of the interview, we were able to back them down and go forward and learn a lot about abuses which occurred. But this is the fight that has to be fought in every circumstance, especially in terms of national security, because they are hiding behind it to cover up misconduct, period. You know, that's what they're doing. There's no great secret, as we all know, that somehow is going to harm America. What is harming America are the violations committed by the intelligence agencies that they then cover up through good old-fashioned bullying. I hope I answered the question. I know that was for a lot.
Thank you very much.
Sibel, you had interjected there that this is an interesting way for you to look at it. Explain your perspective, please.
Now, Steve is right, because I did, and I do, in many ways, consider myself as a person who lost in this deal, you know, trying to do all the right thing and pursuing all the right channels, whether it's the Inspector General's office or actually going to court, knowing that I have witnesses, I have documents, and they could just come out there and invoke this state secrets privilege, which is not even constitutional, and being able to quash it completely, not certain aspect of my case or certain aspects, but quashing the entire case. And here you had the Attorney General and the Department of Justice, and then on top of it, in addition to it, to see that the courts, our judges, our federal judges, without even questioning or challenging this, accepting it. And to me, that was the biggest defeat, and I felt a defeat not only for myself, but also for the country. But what Steve just said actually makes a lot of sense. Unfortunately, we didn't, and we don't have the media to really put this angle forward and say, look at this. They invoke the state secrets privilege. You have the Inspector General's report vindicating this case. What are they hiding? Okay? And they were afraid because they knew she had the right, you know, on her side. And to this day, and this is 8 years, I never looked at it this way. Thank you, Steve.
Well, thank you. But it's interesting because your case comes up in discussions on the Hill, in policy discussions. And, you know, we always are able to point to the Inspector General findings and to the frivolous nature of the use of the state's secrets privilege in your case. It has undermined the legitimacy of the state secrets privilege. Now, if there were five or six more Sibel Edmonds, we'd get rid of that privilege, you know, and that's really where it comes down to, you know, whether people have the courage to stand up and push back on this and use their cases to expose the sometimes the frivolous nature of this national security bogeyman that scares people off. And what Sibel did was extremely significant, because they haven't invoked it, at least in any other whistleblower case that I've done. And I've now, since her case, we've worked on some highly sensitive matters, and they just haven't done it. I think they realized they overplayed their hand in Sibel's case. But the real issue is whether we can fix it, and that's going to be a big uphill battle. I know Congress is debating it now, whether to do a legislative fix to prevent these abuses. We're trying to get something to prevent future abuses. But, it, you know, Sibel's case really blazed the trail. And, you know, I'm hoping that some of these other cases will also point it out. But there aren't that many whistleblowers that took it as far and really exposed it as well as Sibel did. And I'll always take my hat off to her for that, because calling public attention in the way she did to these abuses has helped many other people. I think that the government is just afraid now of doing it again. But we have to clean up the law, period. And unfortunately, many people look at what happened to Sibel and they say, man, I can't blow the whistle. I don't want to end up and, you know, have my career ruined like happened to her.
And Steve, it strikes me, because I've had the opportunity to talk to Sibel over the many years of this protracted saga in her case. And one thing that has struck me is that she's an American citizen, and she takes that very seriously, in part because she wasn't born here and because she came here seeking the freedoms that we advertise worldwide. And without getting into, you know, any kind of generalizations, but just as you know, based on your experience, do you find that people who are born in the United States and subjected to some sort of unlawful dismissal that turns them into a whistleblower, that they're less in touch with their constitutional rights and more willing to trade them away or compromise them?
It's a very good point. I'd say I'd have to answer in the negative to that. I think what you need to be a successful whistleblower, one of the things is a strong value structure that's not tied to what your employer says is right or wrong. Now, so if you look at Sabell's case or a case of an immigrant who comes in and really believes in the American core freedoms, is that person, you know, if they have an employer who says, you know, violate this or violate that, you know, there might be a chance that that employee, like Sabell, would say, no, you know, I know what dictatorships are like. I know what's right and wrong, and I will assert the rights I have as an American citizen. But I'll give you another example, Fred Whitehurst. You know, his family went back to probably the founding of the Republic. His family was in the military for years, you know, all different wars. You know, he's a white male, crew cut, you know, 6 feet tall, lifetime member of the NRA, and a very, what you would call a typical FBI special agent, three-term veteran combat from the Vietnam War. When he confronted his first whistleblower incident, where it was he had the duty to tell the truth, but he knew the FBI wanted him to lie, what he says he did was he wandered the streets of San Francisco. He was at a trial in San Francisco, and he thought about, you know, what he sacrificed in the Vietnam War, you know, why he volunteered to fight in that war, what were the values that they were asserting there into his own mind. And, you know, and it sounds very similar to what Sabell was going through, but he went through the same type of thought process. And at the end he said, you know, we didn't go through all this. You know, we didn't do these sacrifices just to show up and lie. You know, it does, you know, these freedoms mean something, and someone has to stand up for it. And then he became a whistleblower. But he thought it out very carefully before he did it. And many whistleblowers don't. They just stumble upon it. You know, they blow the whistle, but they really don't see themselves as whistleblowers until they really are in court for a year or two, and they understand that doing your job honestly may not be the American way as viewed by certain high-level managers in very powerful positions.
You're listening to The Boiling Frogs. I'm Peter B. Collins with Sabell Edmonds, and we're talking with Stephen M. Cohn. He's president and co-founder of the National Whistleblower Center. They have a powerful website, and let me just warn you, I went there, and it was several hours later that I had found what I was looking for and felt I'd learned a lot. And the website is whistleblowers.org, whistleblowers with an S, .org. Now, Steve Cohn, you have co-authored about a half dozen books on whistleblower law, among them The Labor Lawyer's Guide to the Rights and Responsibilities of Employee Whistleblowers, The Whistleblower Litigation Handbook, Concepts and Procedures in Whistleblower Law, and Whistleblower Law, A Guide to Legal Protections for Corporate Employees. And without diminishing your work in any way, based on the current state of the law and the experiences of so many whistleblowers, wouldn't the titles all basically be a whistleblower, you're screwed, whistleblower, prepare for the shaft, whistleblower, you can kiss your career goodbye?
You know, I got to tell you something. This is interesting. You know, often whether you win or lose is outside of your control. So if everything is dependent upon winning or losing to give you your value in life, then I think what you're saying is right. Because if you blow the whistle, you're putting yourself at tremendous risk, and there's a lot of horror stories. But I'm a believer in the philosophy that what's really important is the way you live your life and not how things that are sometimes totally beyond your control interact. You know, I have done many, many cases, and I have seen whistleblowers with pretty weak cases that I've represented win their cases. I'm happy they won. I may have been surprised. And I've seen whistleblowers with absolutely brilliant cases, super strong, lose, like Sabell, and often for things that no lawyer, no person could have even predicted. There's no way when we started that case and were working on it did we think they were going to invoke state secrets privilege. It's beyond comprehension. It was frivolous. I would laugh at it. But once they did, they really were underhanded, and it was at that point, under the state of the law, pretty much impossible given the composition of the courts. But what's important that I find in most whistleblower cases, we have won big ones. We have gotten significant damages for some whistleblowers, and many whistleblowers have landed on their feet, have gone back into jobs, and have won their cases in a way that you may define winning. But this is what I like to say. Do not think of whistleblowing as a struggle between David and Goliath. It is not. Because sometimes these big, bad, evil bureaucracies are very, very weak. And the whistleblower does not have one stone in the slingshot. You know, they got many weapons, many potential friends, many ways to win the case. You know, maybe getting support in Congress, maybe from the press, maybe in court. Maybe you're lucky to have a case that can go before a jury, and you can have the Bell could not, as a federal employee, get to a jury, but many federal, whistleblowers can, and you can plead your case. So there are ways to win, and but the key thing is, I like to say I've almost never seen a whistleblower case that I think lost. I mean, yes, Sabelle lost her job and lost her career in law enforcement, but she also contributed probably more to the public interest than, you know, any single person could ever imagine. You know, so if winning and losing is defined just how it impacts your narrow job, yes, you may lose. But if you define it as a quality of life issue, as a contribution to the public good, you know, you can win. Now, many whistleblowers are very fortunate and can actually have both. They can make significant change, and they can keep their job or get compensation. The unfortunate thing for national security whistleblowers in general is that Congress has been weak. They have refused over the years to give national security whistleblowers the same rights they've given to other workers.
And Steve, I think this is a good place to talk a bit about those rights, whether it's the Merit System Protection Board, MSPB, or the right to have a jury. Can you talk about these rights that the national security whistleblowers are currently excluded from, and then take us to where we are with Congress today and the battle we have been fighting for many, many years, especially you?
Okay, and to understand where we're at today, okay, for private sector workers, it's different. There are now about 50 laws. Many are very strong. But it really depends on what you're blowing the whistle on and where you work. So if you're a doctor, or, you know, you still have almost no protection, but if you're a truck driver, you got great protection. And, you know, it's a hit and miss, but private sector, there are some good laws. Let's talk about federal employees. The problem occurred in 1978 when they passed what's known as the Civil Service Reform Act. They gave rights to federal employees, but made two compromises that were well thought out and have now, on hindsight, have really undermined the protections. The first was they barred federal employees from going into court, so you couldn't get before a real judge. Now, if you think about the U.S. Constitution once again, how they set up judges to be independent, the fact that they constructed a law that did not let federal workers file their cases in federal court tells you that that was a compromise that was wrong, perhaps unconstitutional, but definitely in violation of what the founding fathers understood to be fundamental to the preservation of fundamental rights. But the compromise occurred. The second one was even worse. They actually carved out of any protection what I call so-called national security whistleblowers. And I say it's so-called because most of the whistleblowing that occurs in agencies like the CIA or the FBI isn't related to national security. It can relate to how you're spending federal money. But it doesn't matter what you blow the whistle on, whether it has nothing to do with security, you have no federal statutory rights. They cut you out. And that should never have been permitted. So now we come to today. The impact of those two compromises haunt us right now. If you're a federal employee and you file a claim, you have to go before this board known as the Merit Systems Protection Board. But I mean, and here's the trick. That board, by statute, is political, not judicial. The members of the board are not approved by the Judiciary Committee. They do not have to be lawyers, and they don't have any proven judicial qualifications. Instead, they're approved by the Government Homeland Affairs Committee. They are political by nature and intended to be so. Two members of the board are always members of the political party that runs the White House. And one member of the board is a member of the outside party. So now you'll have two Democrats and one Republican. When Bush was in power, you had two Republicans and one Democrat. But what it's telling you is that this board that reviews whistleblower rights is political, and it's clearly designed to prevent scandals and to do the bidding of the party in power. How can you have whistleblower cases that by their nature are controversial, heard by a political board and not by a court? And that is the thing, like, number one, we are fighting that. We're demanding that that be changed and that federal employees have the right to go to real judges, real courts, have a trial by jury like any other American. Or as I like to say, one Hill staffer said it right. They said, get out of Gitmo. You know, the Gitmo detainees have more rights than federal employees. They at least can get into federal court. Now, let's talk about the national security exclusion.
Let me just ask you before you move on there, because I really only recently learned about the Merit Systems Protection Board, and you just described the political makeup of the three members. Has it ever ruled, in your opinion, in a fair way that reflected the case before it and not the political mandates of the party in power?
Yeah, never. First off, it rules on behalf of whistleblowers in less than 1% of all cases. Less than. Now, we have done studies, and it's interesting, I even met with people from foreign countries who've done studies of whistleblower legislation, and the way it goes, and I think the statistics are, you know, many cases settle, and in the private sector they can settle for significant monies. You know, $1 million settlement is not out of the question. If you settle a case in the merit systems process, you know, if you get a couple bucks, you're lucky because they're telling you you're going to lose anyway. But the cases that do not settle, the tough litigated cases, employees win at least 35% of them, if not more, but at least 35%. So if in another law whistleblowers are winning 35%, but under this law they win less than 1%, and then you figure out that there pretty much are no good settlements under the merit systems law and a lot of good settlements under the other laws, you know, it's a radical change in your chance of winning and what your rights are. But no, we won't file a case in front of the merit systems board anymore.
I see.
It's a disgrace. We're not going to waste people's time and money.
Thank you, Steve. And I interrupted you as you were about to talk about the national security exclusion.
Now, the national security exclusion, in my view, is insult to injury. So they create a board that's highly political, and now over history we see whistleblowers cannot win. But they just won't even give that right to national security whistleblowers. You get nothing. Now, here's something very interesting. The General Accounting Office conducted an investigation and reviewed all of these laws and determined that for national security whistleblowers, there is no reason to exclude them from full protection, including the right to go to federal court for full trials. No reason. And this was a GAO report specifically designed to review protections in the NSA and the CIA. So this exclusion has no basis in reality. In other words, there is no reason for it to exist. And, you know, we know that by having represented national security whistleblowers, seen what their cases are about, and the injustice in pushing them out of the system. But the General Accounting Office knows it because they actually reviewed every case, every employment case filed in the CIA and the NSA, and lo and behold, their conclusion was there's no reason to cut the whistleblowers out of protection. So that's so now we're at the new administration. You know, what's going to happen now with the new president?
And that's what I wanted to ask you about.
Yes, yeah, and here's
about
what happened.
President Obama's change on the change of the whistleblower protection from his campaign days to right now, and also where we are currently with Congress on these national security protections under the whistleblower law.
Okay, what happened was when the presidential campaign started, even in the primary days, the National Whistleblower Center did a survey of all candidates. And those survey results are on our website, whistleblowerswithans.org. So you can see how each and every one responded. The first candidate to respond to the survey was Barack Obama. Hillary Clinton carefully studied the survey and personally signed it, and they both answered in the same way. And what we did was we didn't just ask a general question, you know, do you like whistleblowers? You know, everyone says they do now. We said, will you support H.R. 985? Which allowed for jury trials for federal workers and protected national security whistleblowers. We also asked, would you support for all employees the rights people have under Title VII to be free from race discrimination? And just so you know, is an FBI agent or a CIA agent can go into federal court if they claim discrimination on the basis of race, age, or sex. So we said, will you expand those rights to whistleblowers? So these are very specific questions with named legislation and existing procedures. Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton both answered yes to both, and so did most of the other candidates. So President Obama was on record as supporting H.R. 985, and, as they say, this civil rights inclusion for whistleblowers. And they both pretty much are the same. They end you in the same place, the right to go to federal court with a jury trial for reasonable damages. Candidate Obama on the campaign stump endorsed whistleblowers. Rahm Emanuel, his chief of staff, issued a press release praising Bunny Greenhouse. He voted for H.R. 985. And Vice President Biden, who is then Senator Biden, strongly supported another national security whistleblower who we'll discuss in the future. So the Democratic leadership was strong in support of the whistleblowers. And there were other statements made. We attempted to attach federal employee whistleblower rights onto the stimulus law. Why? You're going to spend $1 trillion. You need oversight.
Hmm.
Without federal employees who often perform an oversight function, you know, being fully protected as whistleblowers, how are you going to protect that money? Why would a federal employee, you know, blow the whistle on some favored contractor ripping the taxpayer off. That's what happened to Bunny Greenhouse. Ultimately, Sybil Edmonds, you know, was working in a contractor position for the FBI, and she had no rights. You know, who will stand up and say anything if they don't have protection? So we said to Congress, you have to protect the federal regulators. And the House agreed, and they took H.R. 985, which Obama had endorsed, and stuck it onto the stimulus. So it became part of the stimulus that went to the Senate. The White House was silent, and the Senate killed it. In committee, in secret, killed it. That struck out of the bill. So when the stimulus passed, there were no protections for federal employees. Now, and I was very heartbroken when that happened, because I really thought there was a chance we'd get it through. And historically, when whistleblower protections are added to major laws, they get passed.
And
for them to reach in, and as one of the key compromises to get the law through, to strike out protections for federal employees, was a major, major setback for whistleblower protections, one that's going to be hard to recover from.
And Steve, can you name names? Did this occur in the conference committee where we never actually see whose fingerprints are on it, or was it killed in a committee vote?
It was killed, and not even in conference. It was killed by members of the Senate, probably whose names, you know, you really just can't be sure of because no one did anything, that essentially communicated in how they communicate, you know, I don't know. You know, maybe they have a, you know, a secret code. Maybe that's what they don't want us to blow the whistle on. You know, how do they communicate how they're really going to feel? Yeah, we can't know that. But there were definitely people in the Senate that wanted to see it done in. There was no vote, no debate, no written record.
Mm-hmm.
It just was in the House. It wasn't in the Senate. It disappears in conference. And that's the end of it. So, welcome to the democratic process.
And, Steve, what's the current status of your efforts? Are you still working?
Okay.
Do you have a sponsor, and you're trying to attach it to another must-pass bill?
Well, that's what I'd like to see. The problem we had on the Senate side is that some of the people that were the swing votes didn't like it. You know, so it didn't have to go in. Ultimately, in my opinion, if the House holds firm and does it again, which I believe they will, it has to get attached to a bill that the Senate wants to pass, and they can't hold it, you know, hostage. But getting back to what happened is, here's the problem in the House and the Senate. The House has reintroduced H.R. 985, has a different number now. We're strongly supporting it. The Senate has reintroduced another version, and this version does not allow for jury trials or federal court access and excludes national security whistleblowers. So we don't support the Senate version.
Mm-hmm.
And the Senate essentially is not taking it to a vote and still hasn't put it up to markup. And what markup is known as is that's when they take a bill that's just introduced and they all get together, and the committee agrees to what will go for a vote in the full Senate. We understand that that Senate bill will go to markup in another 30 to 60 days. So this is a gigantic issue, and we're trying to get whatever pressure we can on the Senate to, when it goes into markup, to support jury trials and national security whistleblowers. Now, I'll say it's very eerie. No senator has taken to the floor and opposed jury trials or national security protections. No one has said a word. One senator, Claire McCaskill from Missouri, has strongly endorsed jury trials, which is good. She's on the committee.
She's a former attorney general at the state level, too.
Yeah, auditor, attorney general, and she's been a very big champion for whistleblowers. And there's an eerie silence. And it's like, what are they going to do in markup? And the staffers won't say. In other words, it's like an eerie silence. And they know they're under tremendous pressure. But now let's get to the White House, which is the most disappointing move.
Now,
everyone's
Steve,
looking to what the White House is going to do. And Obama had publicly endorsed what we want.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's his staff at a lower level. I cannot attribute it to Obama. There's no evidence he knows even what's going on. But the bureaucrats that have opposed whistleblowers for 30 years are working overtime. They're circulating proposals, and right now they've gotten the White House, the official White House proposal, which bars national security whistleblowers from going into federal court. And there's silence on jury trials. Again, the eerie silence. Nobody knows what they're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that they have publicly backtracked on protection for national security whistleblowers is an outrageous step, and a step that I think there needs to be strong public reaction, and people have to demand that he adhere to those promises.
Steve Cohn, next I'd like to ask you to give us a thumbnail sketch of a small number of cases of recent whistleblowers to give our listeners a sense of how dedicated government employees who are trying to do their jobs and honor their job descriptions and direct orders from superiors were caught up in this political process and lost their jobs in the process. So first, we've referred a few times to Bunatine H. Greenhouse. She was a top procurement officer at the Pentagon, and she objected to the sweetheart no-bid sole-source contracts that were awarded to the Halliburton subsidiary Kellogg, Brown, and Root for the development of the Iraqi oil infrastructure after our invasion and occupation.
Okay. Bunny's case is classic and really should be, and you know, she needs support. She's still fighting hard. And I do want to just give one plug here. I want to say that if you do go to the webpage, whistleblowers.org, you'll get information about how to contact your member of Congress or senator about these bills and how to support whistleblowers like Bunny Greenhouse. But let's just talk about Bunny. It really tells a story. At the height of the hysteria for the war in Iraq, when no one had the courage to stand up against it, and there was, I don't think, anyone in the federal bureaucracy getting up and telling the truth. You know, we know now, oh, they fudged the intelligence. Oh, they didn't do this. They didn't know that. You know, but why didn't these employees have the courage to stand up? Why didn't they blow the whistle? Well, we know they didn't have protection. They didn't want to get their heads cut off. But Bunny Greenhouse did what Sabell did, what some others did, something very unique. When she was her job, she had the equivalent rank of a general in the Army Corps of Engineers, was in charge of the civilian side of public procurement for all major contracts. She was the chief contracts officer, civilian, for these mega-billion-dollar deals, and her signature was required on these contracts to ensure they complied with law. So the Halliburton no-bid contract comes in for the reconstruction of Iraq. She reviews it, and she determines that it's illegal, that it's outside of federal contracting rules, and should not be granted. She is ordered to approve it. She refuses, and she writes on the contract, you know, her protest. She does a written protest on the contract document itself.
Mm-hmm.
And what is so significant about that is she created a record that she opposed the contract. It went through over her objections. It was illegal. And You can only imagine what the bosses thought when they read her contract. This is an improper contract. I protest. So then she had the audacity to have a letter written to Congress about what happened. So she's got two strikes. That's, you know, in the law of federal employee rights, pretty much you only get one strike. She was lucky to have two. They waited until she talked to Congress. They blew their lids. They had proposed removing her before she went to Congress, but they were delaying that decision. The moment she went to Congress, they pulled the rug out from under her and removed her as the chief contracts officer, removed her from her senior executive service position, retaliated against her, and broke her heart. She spent her entire life. She was the first African-American to rise to that level in contracting, perhaps in the federal government, definitely within the Army Corps, and she lost that position. She was not fired completely. They demoted her and shoved her into a basement, hoping it would shut her up, hoping she'd leave, but she's fighting on. And, you know, they sent a message to other procurement people, you know, let the billions of dollars of waste flow in Iraq. That's what they said. They said, if there's corruption in contracting in Iraq, we don't care. And we all know now that billions was wasted over there. I mean, they're printing up the money and sending it over, mm-hmm. you know, in truckloads, cash.
And our listeners to the Boiling Frog series can hear an in-depth comment and interview with Bunateen Greenhouse. Just look for it in this series of podcasts. Now, Steve, next I'd like to talk about another Pentagon whistleblower, and this is a gentleman who was trying to do his job. His name is Franz Gehl, and he was ordered by a general to report for duty in Iraq and to investigate the problems, the casualties, including severe loss of life by American troops due to the improvised explosive devices. And he essentially discovered that there were political and military politics problems in the delivery of these hardened vehicles called MRAPs that are specifically designed to deflect these explosives rather than absorb them. And he tried time and time again to do his job and was stifled by his superiors because in his report he was critical of the Marine Corps' procurement process, in particular as it related to the safety of our troops on the ground.
Yeah, and again, he lost his position, and he was retaliated against. But let's just look again at his case and see what's actually going on. The fact that our trucks over there, tanks or armored carriers, whatever they were, could be blown up by these explosive devices was no secret. You know, the Iraqi resistance knew it. They were doing it almost every day. The soldiers knew it. They were dying. The American public knew it. They watched it on TV. I mean, what's the secret here? They weren't protecting our troops. This, you know, but what was being suppressed? What was being suppressed is that Americans died improperly. Was that they should have taken corrective actions. They could have taken corrective action, and they didn't. And I want to tell you, when Ernie Fitzgerald, the father of modern federal whistleblowing, stepped forward in 1968 and got on Nixon's hit list. When he got on Nixon's hit list, it was because he was so incensed, Ernie Fitzgerald, that soldiers were dying in Vietnam from equipment that was improperly manufactured by greedy contractors. I mean, American troops have died in every war as a result of greedy contractors. It's not just those ads you see on television by Lockheed and others about, you know, how patriotic they are. You know, people have profited from selling defective equipment to the government. And that's what's going on. It's as old as time, profiting from war. And that's why we need these whistleblowers, and that's why the whole national security excuse is just so invalid, because in Bunny's case, everyone knew Halliburton got the no-bid contract. In the case of the of these explosives. Everyone knew that the vehicles were being blown up. What's the secret? Is the secret is that government officials and their friends in hot, very well paid, you know, contracting jobs could, you know, are profiting while the American people pay for suffering.
Well, and Steve, the secret was not a secret either, that there were elections looming, and this information was suppressed to avoid embarrassment that could have a political price.
Yeah, and there's no doubt, and there we go to the rub. Former Senator, now Vice President Biden, strongly supported this whistleblower, wrote letters, but the whistleblower is still out of a job. You know, we need a truth commission. We need somebody, we need the American people to stand up and say, these whistleblowers deserve and need justice. Sabell needs justice, Bunnettine Greenhouse needs justice, and many others who did their job. And I want to say, you know, that is when we begin to turn the page. You know, is when we the American people, force our government to recognize the contribution of the whistleblowers, fix what they did, and move on as a nation.
Steve, I truly admire your persistence. I guess I came to this burnout point with the Congress. Up until 2006, November, we were being told that the additional protection that we have been requesting, we were requesting back then, they were all being blocked by the Republicans, the majority. Then came January, February 2007, and those friends we had who were promising, at least most of them, they disappeared. And, of course, the change with the president. So now we are at this stage. We are coming to this crucial turning point with this new upcoming legislation. And we know that we don't have the media. Sure, we get an article here or there by Congressional Quarterly and whatnot, but we really don't have the support and the pounding of the mainstream media, because that's very, very important. These representatives, no matter what, they don't want to look at least too bad. So we don't have that mainstream media. We don't have the hundreds or millions of dollars of the lobbying firms. How do we get the Congress move? How do we get the public support we need when we don't have the media and we don't have the millions of dollars?
Well, Sabell, I think you're on to it once again with a blog and with the Internet and with communications at the direct grassroots level. And, you know, you've now put together a respected blog to start getting the information out, networking with others, you know, we're no longer, you know, and just in my day, it's amazing how the former monopoly of the large media has been disintegrating before our eyes. You know, they know it. They're no longer as profitable as they used to be. Their readership has gone down. In many ways, it's because they were too cozy with the establishment, and they weren't willing to be critical, and the blogs have picked up to their credit on many of these issues.
And that's exactly what we are going to do.
And that's what we need done. That's the way it's going to happen. It's going to happen from the grassroots up.
We are going to put the word out there. Peter?
Well, Steve, just one final question, and I'm not suggesting at all cynicism on your part, but you have basically inferred here over the course of our conversation that it will be the cumulative effect of various whistleblowers. And if I can paraphrase the question that anti-war veteran John Kerry posed back in 1970, who will be the last to die for the mistake of going into Vietnam? Who will be the last whistleblower to suffer the humiliation and personal loss of being fired for doing their jobs before we will develop a consensus and the public attitudes will be able to move these senators in particular, who were there really hell-bent on protecting the hides of other people?
It's darkest before the dawn. Who will be it? I don't want to be that person, but that person's going to be out there. They come out every day. There are many, many whistleblowers brave, but I want to say this. I always take my inspiration from the anti-slavery movement, because if, you know, in 1859... you know, it sure looked like slavery had the upper hand. You know, the Supreme Court issued the Dred Scott decision. Some people interpreted the Constitution as supporting slavery. The slave power held, you know, could block anything in the Senate. They had had the presidency for most of the history of the Republic. They sure looked unstoppable, and they were gone, totally discredited in a very quick, short period of time. If you actually look at what's happening, and this is something that did not exist, Sibel, when you were blowing the whistle. You know, whistleblowing has become popularized and internationalized. I've been invited to Hungary, to the Czech Republic. We're now getting invited to South Korea. You know, people want whistleblower laws. People are recognizing that whistleblowers are significant. Then these polls came out that showed that 77% of the American public supported whistleblowers. And all of a sudden, there aren't any politicians willing to publicly oppose the whistleblowers. And when they're called out, they quickly run and they say, oh, no, I support. It's hard to catch them behind closed doors, but it's a change in attitude. But listen to this one, which is really shocking. The most significant corporate auditing firms that have done scientific studies on the reporting of misconduct fraud, and this is Ernst & Young, a major corporate auditing outfit, Price Waterhouse Coopers, a gigantic corporate auditing firm, and a group known as the Ethics Council, which is funded by corporations, and the major auditing society conducted scientific surveys on how fraud and misconduct is detected in real life. All four of them concluded that the number one source for this reporting are employees, and that whistleblowing must be protected and encouraged. This is phenomenal. There has never been this type of evidence. I mean, Sibel knows it's true. She lived it. She saw the abuse. She knew that it was her who witnessed it and had the duty to disclose it. Bunny, same thing. She saw the illegal contract. Someone had to stand up. But what these major corporate establishment auditing firms have concluded, that this is not unique. This is now the backbone of any compliance program that will ever work. So we in the whistleblower rights community, we should not be on the defensive. If you want to stop crime, if you want to stop illegalities, there's only one way to do it. You have to protect the workers who witness it and come forward, period.
Yes, indeed.
And if you don't, you are a friend of corruption, period. I mean, is that's the issue. The issue is for the politicians. Not whether you support whistleblowers, but is are you supporting corruption, and are you personally profiting from that corruption? Because if you don't support corruption, the studies of the major, you know, as I say, these corporate auditing firms and the ethics councils, all four studies concluded the same thing and pretty much the same statistics when they looked at it. It was the whistleblowers and the employees that were the core critical element. And it's funny, you have a company like Ernst & Young saying, protect whistleblowers, or PricewaterhouseCoopers. I mean, PricewaterhouseCoopers was sued by whistleblowers. Mm-hmm. They were sued under the False Claims Act. Yet, in their auditing capacity, they conclude that you need protection for whistleblowers or this fraud will run rampant. This did not exist 5 years ago. This is all new. So the momentum on our side is strong. We just need to get out to the grassroots. We need to talk to the voters. We need to talk to the constituencies. We need to go around the established special interests, be they in the media or be they financial, that are ignoring the issue, and get directly to the grassroots rank and file and assert ourselves. And I actually think we're on the cusp of winning this and getting significant rights for whistleblowers. But I'll tell you right now, 5 years from now, I'll say the same thing, because the cause is righteous and we cannot stop until we win this.
Stephen M. Cohn, Executive Director of the National Whistleblowers Center. That's K-O-H-N, the spelling. And you can visit their website at whistleblowers, with an S, whistleblowers.org. Steve Cohn, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve. Joining us. We'll be back soon with more Boiling Frogs interviews. Until then.